Over the next several weeks, you're going to come to a real understanding of what we mean when we say come together. We're talking about what you see on these banners, spiritual friendships, connections with other believers, and how God uses that in your life. And some of you already get it to some extent, but it's my prayer that you're going to learn some things these weeks together that you don't know right now, and that will help you tremendously in your ability to follow Jesus the way you really want to follow Him. And I want to begin today to illustrate it by asking, how many of you enjoy running as exercise? How many of you run much? Now, Brother Jamie over here and several on our staff, they do it religiously. I don't. They do. And back in April in London, over 30,000 people participated in the London Marathon. It won't surprise you to know that the person who won it was from Kenya. They seem to win all those marathons, 26.2 miles. He ran it, and I believe it was 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 44 seconds. Think about that. Amazing. But one of the more inspiring stories from that marathon last April in London was the lady in the picture on the right, the shorter one. Her name is Simone Clark. She's 39 years old. When she was age 5, they diagnosed her as having epilepsy. Most days, she has about 4 seizures. She wanted to run in the marathon for a lot of reasons. One was to raise money for the Epilepsy Society, and she knew that to do so, she would need a friend to train with her and run with her in case she had a seizure. The lady standing beside her is Tally Hall, her really good friend, who decided, all right, I'll do that with you. And so she trained with Simone. She ran with her, and they did the marathon together. And everything started out fine. About mile 8, she had a seizure. And she collapsed, and Tally was there to catch her and lay her softly on the ground. And for about 30 seconds, Simone was unconscious. When she came to, she got up, and she continued running. Now, during training for the marathon, she would run 20 miles or so quite often, and it wasn't unusual for her to have 1 or 2 seizures while she would run those 20 miles. But she had another physical problem this day, and the result was, after she had that first seizure at about mile 8, over the next 18 miles, Simone Clark suffered 19 seizures. Each time she collapsed and spent a few seconds unconscious. Each seizure, as she would fall, her friend Tally was there to catch her, lay her softly on the ground, care for her until she woke up. And every time, Simone would get up and keep running. She finished that marathon in 6.5 hours, more than 3 times as long as it took the winner. But she finished. She finished. And speaking to the press, she said, and this is a quote, "It's all thanks to Tally. Without her, I would never have been able to do it." Now, if you haven't figured this out yet, you will before long. The Christian life is not a sprint. It's a marathon. It's important that you and I, as followers of Jesus, finish. Not only is it important we finish, it's important that we are dedicated, that we are determined, that we do our best, that we do it well. And there will be times when all of us, in one way or another, for varying reasons, quote-unquote, have seizures, face issues, challenges in life that can have an impact on our spiritual life, on our walk with Jesus Christ. And we need some people in our life like Tally Hall was to Simone Clark. We need some fellow believers like her. It's a lot harder to do well alone, in isolation, even though that's how a lot of us try to do it. And so in this sermon series, Over the next several weeks, we're going to learn the importance of being connected to other believers, the importance of spiritual friendships, of being part of small groups of believers where we can catch one another, encourage one another, pray for one another, help one another. Not just be a part of the church, not just attend worship, but be connected to other believers on another level. And we're going to learn that God uses those connections tremendously in our spiritual development. Now, some of you are saying, man, I wish I had that kind of friend. I wish I had that kind of other believer in my life. Here's the catch. You want those kind of people in your life? Then be that kind of person for others. You want people to be there for you? Be there for others. Because too often in the church and in our Christian culture, we moan and we complain and we gripe about other people and this and that, and they're not that and they're not that. What about, how often do we look in the mirror and ask not only what kind of friend do we need, ask what kind of friend am I? Because it goes both ways. See, spiritual connections is not about just other people for you. It's also about you for them and the impact that has not only on their lives, but on your own life, on your own walk with Jesus Christ. So I invite you to open your Bible as we get started today to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8. In your New Testament, Matthew, Mark, second book of the New Testament, Mark, chapter 8. Now here's the background for what we're going to read. Jesus has been speaking to large crowds. And with him on this particular occasion are his 12 disciples. And he issues to that large crowd an invitation for those who choose to become followers. And in so doing, he spells out for them his expectations that if you're going to follow me, then this is what it involves. Following me looks like this. Following me means that you approach life this way, that you are this type person. You have this attitude about living. Here's the expectations, the standards, whatever you want to call it, for following him. And so let's stand in honor of God's word as we read together Mark chapter 8, verses 34 and following. Mark chapter 8, verses 34 and following. The Bible tells us that Jesus summoned the crowd with his disciples. So here's this large crowd of listeners and his 12 disciples with him. And then he said to them, to this large crowd, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. So Jesus is speaking to this large crowd, and he says, I'm inviting you to follow me. Be one of my disciples. Now, if you're going to do that, can't be ashamed of me. If you're going to do that, it means you no longer live primarily for yourself, but you live for God. You live for the kingdom of God. Doesn't mean that your life's not important. It is important, but you don't live selfishly. You live a life of surrender and commitment, dedication, and you're not ashamed of me. He said there's certain standards, certain expectations if you're going to follow me. Now, I'm inviting you. I'm inviting you, and I want you to follow me. But here's what it looks like. Thank you, and you can be seated. Now, knowing expectations matters. But not only knowing them, doing them matters. Yesterday, Stephen, who's with us this weekend, he and I got to watch several college basketball games. Man, there were a lot of great games yesterday. Exciting games, right down to the wire. I mean, Wichita State beat Creighton. And then the best one last night, Butler. Butler beating Gonzaga on that, you know, that steal with 4 points some seconds to go and then hitting that basket with a tenth of a second If you didn't see that, you need to get online and watch it today. That was fantastic. That was a great game. And then Louisville, who was ranked number one, was upset at home by Syracuse and should have won the game, but turned the ball over on their last two possessions, and Syracuse scored at the end to win. And I caught part of Rick Pitino, Louisville's coach, I caught part of his press conference after the game, and man, he was ticked. He was not happy with anybody. He didn't like the reporters. He didn't like his players. He was not a happy camper. And he said during that last timeout, they had called a specific place, and his two-guard, Russ Smith, was to go to the corner. That was one of the options for Siva, the point guard. Russ, go to the corner. And on the play, when the ball was turned over and Syracuse scored and they lost, Russ Smith didn't do what he was told to do. He didn't go to the corner. Play broke down. Louisville gets beat. And you can argue about Pitino throwing this player under the bus in the press conference, but I'm telling you, the guy was ticked and he was calling him out. Didn't do what was expected. Cost the team. Now Jesus says, I'm inviting you to follow me, and there's all these benefits, and your life will be transformed. But understand, if you follow me, then it involves certain things. This is the kind of person, the kind of life you live. I want you to know what's expected when you follow me. Now, in that crowd, as people listened to Jesus, some people heard him and they said, no, not for me. And you and I have relatives, we have co-workers, we have friends who, man, for whatever reason, they keep saying no to Christ. There are some of you in this room today, you're listening and you're interested, but for some reason, to this point, you've not said yes. I'm praying today you say yes to Christ. But there were also a lot of people in that crowd who did say yes to Jesus' invitation. And many of us are here, in fact, probably most of us are here today because on some level we've said yes to Christ. Yes, we want to follow you. Yes, we want to be your disciple. Yes, we want to live for you and serve you. We've said yes to Jesus Christ. So the question for those who have said yes is this. How do we become the kind of follower who meets Jesus' expectations? How do we become the kind of disciple who matures and grows and develops into what Christ is calling us to become and to be? Well, there's a lot involved in that. But what we're going to do over the next several weeks is look at how Jesus helped those as described in the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Look at how Jesus enabled those who accepted his invitation during his earthly ministry. How did he help them become the kind of disciple he said he expected them to be? And learn from that example. Because it just makes sense that if we're going to maximize our spiritual development, then we need to learn from how Christ did it in the lives of his followers when he was here. Does that make sense? So that's what we're going to spend the next several weeks doing. And here's what we will discover. We're going to discover that, yes, Jesus spoke to large groups of people, like I'm speaking to hundreds right now. We're going to discover, yes, that Jesus would spend alone time with God in prayer. And we need our alone time. We need our quiet time. We need our prayer time alone. But we're also going to discover that Jesus very intentionally helped his followers develop spiritually through processes that involved their being connected in smaller groups with other believers. That if all you have is this worship experience, that's not sufficient. If all you have is a long time, you and God and your prayer and your study, if that's all you, it's not sufficient. That somehow God uses our experience in connection with other believers to maximize our transformation, our spiritual development. Now, one of the reasons that it doesn't happen sufficiently in a setting like this, now God uses these services in large groups. I mean, if he did not, I should be the most discouraged person here today. But God uses settings like this to encourage, to challenge, to call to decision, to call to commitment, to inspire. But God uses some of these other settings to change, to help us deal with issues, to pick us up when we can't get up by ourselves, or to help us to allow us the privilege of helping someone else up who can't get up by himself or herself. Because in a setting like this, you can hide. You can sit here and you can hear from God, but you can still hide because you don't have to deal with stuff. You don't have to talk about stuff. You don't have to confront stuff. You don't learn how to do stuff just sitting in here. And by the way, guys, let me talk to the men for a minute. Guys, isn't it true that most of us, not all, because there are exceptions, but most of us learn best by talking about things while we're doing something rather than just sitting in a classroom setting. Isn't that true? God just wired men that most of us are hands-on learners. We learn while doing and being shown, not just sitting and listening. So if all you get is this, then you're limiting your opportunity to develop spiritually. Are you with me? You hear me? Is this clicking? So today I'm going to lay a biblical foundation for the groups that Jesus used and the importance of those connections. And then in the weeks to come, look at how Jesus used these processes of getting his followers in increasingly smaller groups, how he used that process to help them in very specific areas of their spiritual life. But today I want us to look at, just lay a foundation, a biblical foundation for this. Because most of us, when we think of Jesus in groups, we think of the 12 disciples, right? If I said Jesus used groups in his ministry to develop his followers, the first group that comes to mind is who? It's 12 disciples. And for most of us, that's the only group we think about. Here's the thing. In the Gospels, Jesus worked with a lot of groups beyond the 12 disciples. That was not his only group. And they were organized at different levels and in different ways and different sizes. So let's spend the next 10, 15 minutes just doing a little bit of Bible study. Look at some verses, all of them in the Gospel of Luke. So go ahead and turn to the Gospel of Luke, if you will, chapter 6. And we're going to look at these verses and see some of the groups that Jesus worked with to help his followers develop. And then the weeks to come, how he used those groups in specific ways to help people and in with their spiritual growth, so you and I can learn about that. But today, let's understand the value of being connected with other believers beyond just this setting. Okay? And since the one you're familiar with is the 12, that's where we're going to start. And you're going to discover that Jesus had the 12. He also had a subset of the 12, the 3. He had a group of 70 that he then divided down into groups of 2 each. He also had larger groups of followers. So let's just look quickly at some of this. Luke chapter 6, this is when Jesus chose and named the 12 disciples that we normally think about, okay? And let me go ahead and turn in my Bible, get over to the same passage with you. Luke chapter 6, verse 12. The Bible says that at this time, Jesus went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. So he's on this mountain praying all night, and the following morning in verse 13, when day came, he called his disciples to him, and he chose 12 of them, whom he also named as apostles. Now notice what it says there. Who did he call to himself? All of his disciples. The disciples, listen, it's not, the disciples are not limited to the 12. Anyone who is a follower of Jesus is a disciple, is a learner. It's what the word basically means. We're all disciples of Christ. And so Jesus calls to himself this large number of followers, this large number of disciples, and from that group of followers, he chooses and appoints 12 specific ones. It would be like me coming down and looking at all the men in this room today and saying, all right, Ricky and Steve, and just go through and name 12 of you, okay? See Michael sitting over here last year. Michael was a part of a group of 12 that I met with for most of a year periodically just to talk about stuff and work on spiritual life and learning and growing and invest in them, and they invested in me. Well, that's what Jesus is doing. He looked out, and from all of these followers, he chose 12. Now, he's going to pour himself into these 12. He's going to invest in them because they become the key leaders of the early church. And so he spends time with them and teaching them. And so he calls them in verse 13, and then in the following verses, they're named. Now, you go down to verse 17. Jesus came down with them and stood on a level place. And there was a large crowd of his disciples and a great throng of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and from the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon who had come to hear him. So get this picture. Who all is involved in this scene? Here's Jesus. And there's this vast crowd, this audience that's interested in hearing him. They were not all believers. They were not all followers. They wanted to hear him. Think of a Billy Graham crusade at the, at Bank of America Stadium. Do they still call it Bank of America Stadium? Okay. You know, those things change all the time. And Billy Graham's up there and he's preaching and there's thousands and thousands and thousands of, not everybody in that audience is a believer, right? So Jesus has this huge crowd. Not all of them are believers, but in the midst of that crowd at the stadium when Billy Graham preaches are a lot of Christians. So Jesus has in this crowd a lot of disciples, a lot of followers. And also in that crowd are the 12 that he's just appointed. And when you begin looking closely at the Gospels, you see, when you really pay attention, these different levels of organization within the life and ministry of Jesus. So we have the 12. Now, Jesus spent 3 years with these guys. I mean, he invested in them. Jesus did not do all or even most of his teaching with the 12 in a classroom setting. So much of his teaching and interaction with them happened while they were traveling from place to place, while they were doing ministry together. There were times when they would ask him questions and he would answer, times when he would ask them questions and then use those as teachable moments. And somehow in the church world, you and I have to get outside of this box that all of our learning and all of our spiritual growth and all of our spiritual development happens in a traditional classroom setting, because it doesn't. Especially for men. So guys, what are you doing? Ladies, what are you doing to expose yourself to a smaller group than this worship service so that you can grow spiritually? And by the way, those of us who are leaders of ministry here at this church, what are we doing to engage people within the groups that we're a part of that we're leading in a smaller way for their development? Hey, Randy, in your coaching career, did you ever take one player over here and work with him one-on-one? Did you ever ask a group of three players to show up and work with them on some drill? It's not just the whole team all the time, right? Okay. That's what Jesus did. If you're a Sunday school leader, if you're a ministry leader in this church, why do you think that all of your, if you just do whatever you do with a large group and that's all you ever do, you've done your job? If you're wanting to maximize the spiritual development of the people within that group. So we have the 12. But let me show you another group. We have the 70. Turn to Luke chapter 10. We're just going to stay in the Gospel of Luke for a few minutes, okay? Look in chapter 10, verse 1. Now, after this, the Lord appointed 70 others. Now, notice what it said there. It doesn't say that here was this group of 70 guys. Jesus appointed them. He selected them. He chose them. So out of this large group, he had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of followers. We already saw he chose the seven, but here what he chooses what? A group of 70. Totally different group. He chooses them. He appoints them. And then he gave them a task. And to fulfill that task, broke them down into smaller subsets. Notice what it says. That he appointed the 70 others and he sent them in pairs, in groups of two, ahead of him to every city and place where he himself was going to come. That like an advance team, a logistics team. But they also were an evangelistic team. And in verse 17, the 70 returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. And they go on to describe for Jesus what happened while they were out doing ministry in his name. All they had seen God do. So Jesus chooses these 70 and he teaches them and then he gives them an assignment. And says, now I want you to work in teams of two. Then they came back to him and there was a debriefing. Now, does that sound like it was totally in a classroom setting? No. And by the way, the joy, remember that in verse 17, joy. Do you know how you're going to have the greatest joy in your life? It's when you're engaged in evangelistic ministry because you will see life change. And I'm going to tell you something. God will do more to transform you as a Christian when you are engaged with unbelievers, helping them know Christ. Because when that happens, you're on the front line of spiritual warfare where heaven meets hell and lives are changed. And you see God do more than you will see him do in any other place in your life. But we hide and don't want to talk to anybody. No wonder we're not growing like we should. We're ashamed of the gospel. We're afraid to open our mouth. No wonder we're so weak at times spiritually. We're like that Louisville guard that didn't go to the corner. I don't know what would have happened. Nobody but God knows what would have happened. What if Russ Smith had gone to the corner? Maybe that game would have turned out differently yesterday. And rather than being sad and not able to sleep last night, they might have been happy and slept like a baby. You want joy in your life? Obey Jesus. You want joy in your life? Engage with other believers in growing and learning and doing and developing. And stop isolating yourself. Stop hiding. You see, spiritual development is not just about learning Bible content. It's about doing ministry that impacts people's lives. Our churches are filled with people that have so much information up here. But you see, discipleship involves not only the head, it involves the heart, it involves the hands, it involves the feet, it involves all of us. The 70. All right, now let me show you the three. Turn to Luke chapter 8, because within the 12 disciples, Jesus broke that group down, and there were three of them that he invested in even more heavily than he did the other nine. And you'll see why in a minute. Look in Luke chapter 8. Again, laying biblical foundation. Chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is gone to the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader whose daughter had just died. And he raises her from the dead. And in Luke 8, 51, when he came to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him, go into the room where her body was. Except Peter and John and James and the girl's parents. They go in there, they close the door, and he raises her from the dead. They saw something that the other nine did not see. They experienced something the other nine did not experience. Now, by the way, Peter, was he not the one who stood on the day of Pentecost and preached when the church went public and 3,000 people were saved? Was Peter not the apostle who led the outreach efforts to the Jewish people after the resurrection and ascension of Jesus? James, the first of the disciples of the apostles, of the 12 apostles who was martyred for the faith. John, who, as best we can tell, outlived all the other disciples and as an old man suffered persecution by being exiled to the island of Patmos. And God gave this elderly saint, this devoted disciple, the book of Revelation, the Gospel of John, the book of 1 John, 2 John, 3 John. Was Jesus not investing in those three because he knew the prominent place they would have in the early church life? As a ministry leader, who are you investing in to develop, to take your place? To expand ministry impact beyond yourself. And by the way, as a follower of Christ, are you available for that? Are you exposing yourself to that? Are you open to that? Are you seeking that? Or are you hiding in a large crowd? The three. We don't have time, but in Luke chapter 9, when Jesus is on the mountain of transfiguration and Moses and Elijah appear to him from heaven, and Jesus is transformed in the glory of heaven that falls on Jesus as the divine Son of God. And on that mountain, he takes with him these same three, Peter, James, and John. In the Gospels of Matthew and one other Gospel in the Garden of Gethsemane, after Judas has left to betray him, Jesus takes the 11 disciples out to that garden to pray. And when they get there, he leaves 8 of them in this spot, and he takes these three with him further, deeper into the garden. And to those three, he says, sit here and pray with me. That inner circle. So it wasn't just the 12, it was the 3, it was the 70, it was the 2s. But there was another group, a group of women. Look in Luke chapter 8, verses 1 and following. Luke 8, verse 1. And soon afterwards, he began going around from one city and village to another, proclaiming and preaching the kingdom of God. And the 12 were with him. There's the 12 disciples. But verse 2 has that word also, and also some women. Kind of radical for his day, but some women who had been healed of evil spirits and sickness, Mary, who is called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out, and Joanna and Susanna, and many others who were contributing to their support out of their private means. They were his financial backers. For those of you who think there shouldn't be any connection between money and church and ministry and spirituality, no, because, you know, money's that thing that is attached to the most sensitive nerve in the human body, your wallet, you know, it's your purse, your checkbook, that sensitive nerve, because it really reveals your heart. It does. But here's a group of women who are supporting Jesus' ministry, who are with him, that he is mentoring, that he is investing in. By the way, this group of women, this is not the only time they're mentioned. In Matthew 27, when Jesus is hanging on the cross, look at what this next slide. Go ahead and throw the next slide up. Next slide, please. There we go. Many women were there looking on from a distance. This is when Jesus is hanging on the cross, who had followed him from Galilee while ministering to him. And the next verse, verse 56, tells who they were. It's this group of women. They had followed him not only up in Galilee, but as he made his way to Judea and to Jerusalem, and as he's hanging on the cross, they're there. So the idea that Jesus just had a large crowd and the 12 is not accurate. He taught large crowds. What I'm doing right now matters. If you teach a large Sunday school class in this church, that matters. But if all we do is this, if all you expose yourself to is this, you're not doing enough if you want to maximize your spiritual development and become the kind of disciple that Jesus expects you to become. So what do we learn? Let me wrap this up. What do we learn? We learn that Jesus spoke to large crowds of people, followers and those who didn't follow him. And every time he spoke to those large crowds, he invited people to follow him. He wanted them to follow him, but he defined clearly what it means to follow him. Some said no, some said yes. And he had hundreds and hundreds of genuine disciples, of genuine followers. In fact, 1 Corinthians 15 mentions that after the resurrection of Jesus, there was one occasion when he appeared at one time to more than 500 believers. One occasion, more than 500. He had a lot of believers. And he would teach those large crowds and those large gatherings of believers. But what we also learn in the Gospels is that the more intense spiritual development occurred as he broke them down, as he broke them into and worked with them in increasingly smaller groups. Now, if that's how he did it, why do we think we don't need to do that? And if that's how he developed his disciples, why do you think you don't need that? Why do you think all you need is this worship service and then maybe your alone time with God? See, God uses the interactions, the connections. Listen, do you know that God even uses some of the frustrating things that happens in relationships with other believers to help you grow? You want to learn how to forgive, because if you're going to follow Jesus, you become a forgiving Christian, right? You can't learn to be a forgiving Christian if you hide all the time from the people you're mad at. Families learn how to love one another by being together, not running from each other, right? And by the way, if you've got a great marriage or you have a good, healthy, extended family, there have been some tough moments along the way. You've had some intense discussions. Your siblings have done something that ticked you off. And you've got to choose, are you going to love and keep your family or hang on to your hurt and lose it, right? Same thing's true in your spiritual life. If you're hiding from God's people all the time, you are saying, God, I'm going this far and no further. Because you can only go so far in isolation from other believers. God uses the interaction sometimes to show us that maybe we've got a bad attitude about something. God uses those that sometimes when I'm discouraged or I'm hurt, there's going to be a tally hall there to pray for me, to listen to me, to talk to me, to pick me up, to encourage me, to help me. God's going to bless my soul, bless my life, because there's going to be a moment when I'm the tally hall that gets to do that for somebody else. You understand, don't you, that Jesus fills you. He puts it in you so it can come out of you to bless somebody else, not just to stay in you so you can smile and be happy all the time. That the more you let those old songs, the more you let it flow through you and out of you to bless others, the more you get and the happier you are, but the more you shut up and keep it to yourself, the more miserable you become. Right? I mean, stop up a stream, what happens to it? It dies. By the way, I'm so far away from my notes, I don't, you know. They don't have a clue what to put on the screen right now. A pond needs fresh water. Well, if you're not engaging with other people, there's not much fresh water in your life. It says in those smaller groups that Jesus would answer questions. He would ask people questions. He would show them how. It was in a small group the disciples said to him, Lord, teach us how to pray. And he taught them how. And do you know how they really learned to pray? The Gospels tell us, and we'll talk about this one Sunday. They learned how to pray watching him do it in that small group. I learned to pray. The first time I prayed out loud in public, okay, teenagers, listen. First time I prayed out loud in public, I was in high school. I was in a Sunday night group at my church. I hadn't been a Christian in a long time. In a discipleship group, spiritual growth group in my church, high school kids. And we had this circle all holding hands, and they said, just do a sentence prayer, all right? And when it comes to you, you pray. If you don't want to pray, just squeeze the hand of the person to your right. Or when you're finished praying, squeeze their hand and it just goes around. Have you ever done anything like that? That kind of thing. And so somebody squeezed my left hand. It was my time. And I don't know what I said. It was just one sentence. But I said something. First time I ever prayed out loud was in a small setting with about 12 teenagers and one adult leader. I would never have learned to do that in the worship service of my home church with a big old group like this, would I? You get the point? Do you get the point? I learned how to share my faith with people who were not believers because one man mentored me, and he would take me with him on Saturdays to make visits. And I watched him, and I learned, and I studied. And that's how I learned how to talk to people about Jesus Christ. Was in, you know, Jesus took the 70, broke them into groups of what, two, sent them out. That's how I learned with an older, more mature believer. And by the way, you don't have to limit that to something organized in this church. If God puts another believer on your heart who's younger, either in age or younger in the faith, by the way, same sex, men to men, women to women, don't cross gender the thing. Okay? You understand that, don't you? Do you understand that, people? Okay. Men mentor men. Women mentor women. You don't cross gender in one-on-one. You don't do that. You're playing with dynamite, with fire, with it'll blow up in your face. Don't do that. But if God puts another believer on your heart for you to invest in, then start investing in them. You don't need my permission. You don't need to organize it. Just love on another believer and help them. And do you know that you will grow in the process? And by the way, those of you, the only time you're ever in any kind of religious setting is when you come to worship. Man, get into a Sunday school class. Get into a small group. Get into a discipleship group. Get into one of those spiritual growth classes on Wednesday night. Connect with somebody else. Get engaged in some kind of ministry that's hands-on with other believers doing stuff. Don't just sit in this room Sunday to Sunday. Do more than that to maximize your spiritual development. Don't wait for somebody to ask. You want to follow Jesus? Just go do it. Quit using the fact that somebody hasn't asked you to do whatever it is you want to do as an excuse to do nothing. Go take responsibility for your spiritual fellowship of Jesus Christ. All right. Time to close. Been a lot of research along these lines, but not long ago, a study was done of people who had been saved for 5 years. So they looked at people who had accepted Jesus 5 years earlier, and they were wanting to know, are those people still active in church? Okay? Say 5 years ago, 5 years later, are you still active in church? You know what they found? of those who immediately upon becoming a Christian became active in Sunday school or some kind of small group ministry setting with other believers, 83% of them were still active after 5 years, more than 8 out of 10. They also discovered that of those who did not become active in Sunday school or some other small group ministry activity setting with other believers, after 5 years, 16% of them were still active after 5 years. Now, what does that tell you about your potential as a follower of Jesus Christ? Does that have any implications for us? For you? Does it? I think it does. And by the way, that's exactly how Jesus did it. Okay? So do it. What's Nike say? Just do it. Isn't it Nike? Just do it. All right, let's stand. And by the way, if you want to come down here and get on your knees and pray, you're a ministry leader in this church and you want to pray about your leadership and how you're investing in people, you come and do that. If you want God to give you wisdom about how to do it better, you come on. If you're somebody who normally just comes to worship, and I'm so thankful you're here. And listen, I'm not saying God doesn't use you being here. He does. But I want you to have so much more. God wants you to have so much more. And maybe you need to pray this morning about your being open to more. Next Sunday, come an hour earlier and go to Sunday school. Go to the website and look at those classes on Wednesday night and come here for one of these different groups on Wednesday night. Find something. Engaging people. And by the way, talking about sending them out 2x2. Thank you for bringing the food. You've been meeting neighbors and co-workers and bringing food. And more will come this week and next week. Bring your food to the altar. If you've got food and you haven't brought it, bring it on down to the altar here in just a moment. We'll help sing this song. And the ushers are going to be here. We've got some thank you cards. So ushers, if you'll come on down now. The ushers are going to be here across the front.